Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. My guest today, Dick Zondag, president of Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin, celebrating 100 years in business this year. Started back in 1907, family owned the whole time. And Dick, welcome back. Congratulations on 100 years again.
Well, thank you, Larry.
It's a wonderful thing, and you're having a big event. We'll talk about that event a little bit as we go along here through the show. By the way, if you want to join in with your questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. What's the busy thing for you at Jung's this time of year?
Well, right now we're in the field maintaining the crops, so to speak. We're, of course, with the lack of rainfall that we've had, we're irrigating quite a bit. Of course, there are always those nice weeds that keep coming up all the time, so trying to keep the weeds down a little bit. And then in a couple of weeks, we'll be into our shipping seasons again, where we start doing the iris first, and then the daylilies, and then the fall bulbs start coming in September, and we're back in full speed, so... It never seems to be an end of things to do. And then with the centennial celebration, it's added another dimension to our dinner plate, so to speak. And so it's been a very fast but very rewarding year.
Yeah, it has to have been. And this weekend, a big event for the public?
Yeah, we're celebrating, I guess this is probably the biggest event of the year, so to speak, what we're calling Jung Fest. We're actually going to kick it off at 10 o'clock with a small ceremony in front of the company. You know, when the building was built after a fire in 1951, they had an opening ceremony, and we're kind of doing the same thing. We'll have a couple of speakers, and then we'll cut the ribbon again, and we're going to have plant tours and nursery tours, and we're going to have face painting for the kids and bands and an inflatable house for them to jump around on a little bit, and all kinds of foods. We're going to have brats and hamburgers and chicken breasts and steak sandwiches and beer, and, you know, we're just going to have a good time. So
that's Saturday?
That's Saturday, yep, starting at 10, and it'll run until probably 5 or 6 o'clock. So,
that sounds like a lot of fun.
We're,
and everybody's invited.
Everybody's invited, yep.
Well, let's go to Betty in Camp Douglas, see what's on her mind. Hi, Betty.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And congratulations to Dick on the 100th anniversary. He seems way too young for that.
Yeah, I am not quite 100 yet. So there have been a couple generations before me, but, you know, it's been a family affair. There have been several families in the management, and a lot of families that have worked for us that have raised their families and have retired in the company. And so, you know, it's not just the family that has built the business, but we've had a lot of very faithful employees, and not only employees but customers. I mean, without a really loyal stable of customers, you couldn't keep a business in business. So, you know, it's not just the business that has been here for 100 years, but we have 3 and 4 generations of families that have bought their seeds and grown gardens and things with the products from Jung.
Yeah, that's great. And I bet you might have a question, Betty.
Yes, I do have. I had a crop failure with garden peas.
Okay.
They just were blah, you know, like a handful of pods and so forth. And I'm wondering, I'm up in Monroe County.
Okay.
Is it too late for me to replant peas? I'm going to put them in a different place. But
yeah, peas are a cool season crop. They need to start in a cool. And you may want to try, but I don't think there's a whole lot that you'll get out of peas when they're growing in this hot weather. They have to start in the cool weather and then start maturing right now.
Yeah.
The weather we've had, the hot weather has really, although in some parts of the garden it looks really good, but some of the cool season crops have not handled the hot weather and the cool and the dry conditions very well.
All right. What about beets?
Beets you can replant, and also carrots. I always replant a few carrots around Independence Day, because that way, when the cold weather starts, I cover them with 6 or 8 inches or a foot of straw, and then if we do get a nice snow cover, that'll keep the soil from freezing down too hard, and I can go out and dig carrots and some of the root crops all winter long.
Oh, sounds good to me.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Betty. And we'll take some more calls. Here's Carol in Elm Grove. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on the edge of it looks like to me like a dry forest, and maybe there's 200-300 feet of it between lots. Nothing grows there. There's no underbrush. There are no wildflowers. So I'm trying to cultivate something on the edge of it, and the hostas don't do well. So I'm wondering if it's a losing battle, if I have to mulch, if I have to put new soil there and then turn it, or how I could at least cultivate and do something nice around the edges to soften the edge. Is it a losing battle?
This is of the woods?
Yes.
Okay. What you may want to do is plant a cover crop and work that organic matter into the soil. Is it sandy soil? Is it heavy soil?
It's more clay-like.
It's more clay-like.
And when it rains, the rain goes right down, and it's there's probably a heavy root line, you know, because there are a lot of trees.
Okay, what kind of are they maple trees by any chance?
Yes, there's some maple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the problem. The maple trees have a very shallow root system, and what some people end up doing is planting annual rye every year because it comes up really fast and will last the summer. As far as getting perennials going in there may be a few of them. Bishop's goutweed is one that seems to be really aggressive and may handle that type of a situation. Maybe some Lily of the Valley or Bleeding Hearts. The problem is with maples, the root systems are so shallow, and especially when it's hot and dry like this, unless you go out and water quite often, the maple trees will suck up all the moisture and all the nutrients, and so it's really difficult under maple trees.
Is annual rye an ornamental grass? I don't know what
No,
that is.
It isn't. Annual rye is a type of lawn grass.
It's used in
grass mixes because it comes up very fast and will sort of act as a nurse crop for the bluegrass to get started. But in areas where you've got maples, grass doesn't survive very well either. So what you have to do is plant this annual rye every year, and it'll come up and it'll last the summer, but the winter takes it out. It dies in the wintertime.
Oh, that's a great idea. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Carol. And Patrick in Cottage Grove, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking my call. As soon as I heard that the program was on, I had to call in. So we have several raised beds in the backyard, and we grow vegetables in them and herbs. And this last weekend I was having an argument with a debate with my father because it seems like this year I think we put in too much peat moss into the soil. So it seems like the garden isn't growing, the garden isn't growing as well as it did last year. So is there such a thing as adding too much peat moss to the soil?
Yes, you can add too much organic matter, and especially peat, because it doesn't have a lot of nutrients in it. Create a situation where the soil microorganisms are battling the plants for the nutrients that are in there. Now, you can't overdo it with organic matter because high organic matter soils really grow good vegetables because your root crops can penetrate better and they actually do hold nutrients when they're there. I guess what I would do is use some of the soluble plant foods like Miracle-Gro or Fertilome's Rooting and Blooming. Something that will give them some of the nutrients to grow on and see if that doesn't help. But with peat moss, I wouldn't add more than probably 30 to 40% organic matter to a soil. And once your soil is growing well, there really is no need to go back and add more organic matter for a few years because the organic matter just doesn't disappear. It stays there. And maybe adding a little bit of sand will help with drainage, too. You know, put an inch or two of sand on top of those beds and work that in. Because the problem with raised beds is you need to have good drainage. And that sand will add to the drainage of the bed.
Well, I hope my father was listening to that.
Okay. Well, I'm neither. I'm neutral
in family matters.
In family matters, yes, I am.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for your call. Thanks for calling. Frank in Madison, your turn. Hi, Frank.
Yes, good morning. my problem is daylilies. And Larry, you mentioned that it sounded like yours were doing just great. Well, mine are not doing just great. As a matter of fact, earlier in the year, we had blossoms in profusion.
Mm-hmm.
For the last week or two, very few blossoms, and it doesn't seem like anything is going anyplace. I'm just wondering what the problem might be.
Okay, now, the daylily, is the variety Stella d'Oro by any chance?
I'm sorry, I have a bit of a hearing problem. Would you repeat that, please?
Do you know what variety it is?
No, I don't.
Okay.
No, I don't.
What you'll find is that many of the daylilies are rebloomers, but some of them aren't. And so if you've got a daylily that's been in bloom for probably 3 or 4 weeks, that may be all that you're going to get. And one of the things that you can do if it is a rebloomer to get it to rebloom is to take the flower heads off, to remove the seed pods.
I think that it is a rebloomer because my daughter planted these, and she's quite knowledgeable about flowers and daylilies. So
okay.
I'm sure she did mention something about pinching off something to help it generate new blossoms.
Right. If you remove the flower heads once they've bloomed,
right,
that will encourage more flowering to come later on.
My wife was wondering whether Japanese beetles would have any bearing on this.
Well, they could eat the foliage, but they wouldn't reduce the amount of flowering.
Okay. Now, what are these? there are a bunch of these, what I'm going to call little green sort of oblongish nodules. Are those things that supposedly develop into blossoms or flowers?
If they're soft and pliable, they're new flower buds. If they are sort of getting papery and woody, those are the seed pods, and those are what you want to remove.
Oh.
Yeah, because if a plant goes to seed, it's really done its duty.
Yeah.
And it shuts down the flowering. So what you're doing, especially with annuals, but also with some of the perennials, if you remove the flowers stalks after they're done flowering, the plant will immediately go into the flowering mode again, because they're not there for the beauty of the flowers for us.
Mm-hmm.
They're there to produce more seed. And so if you remove the seed part of the plant, it's naturally going to want to throw more flowers out so it can produce more seed. Now, some of the daylilies will not rebloom that way. Some of them have a finite number of blossoms that they'll throw out. But some of them, like Stella d'Oro, if you keep taking the dead flowers out, it will have a beautiful flush when it first starts to bloom. But then it will keep reblooming a few times after the main part is done. But if it does start to go to seed, then the flowers stop coming.
Well, these green nodules that I refer to are not necessarily future blossoms, then. Is that what you're saying?
Right. They may be the seed pods from the flowers.
And they will not do anything, right?
Right. They'll only produce seed.
Well, what? How do I know which they are?
Well, the seed pods will be papery and will start to dry out and start to turn brown.
Oh.
The flower buds will expand. They'll get bigger in size, and then they'll turn into flowers.
Okay.
And they're usually more green and supple.
Yep.
Where the seed pods are more papery and they start to turn brown.
Okay. Well, you've been most helpful, and I do appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. As you and I were talking before the show, the daylilies are just so many gorgeous daylilies.
There are so many people that are breeding daylilies now, and they're both diploids and tetraploids. Some have two sets of genes and some have four sets of genes. And the ones that are the tetraploids tend to be heavier leaf. The leaves are more leathery,
mm-hmm,
but the flowers tend to have a more intense color. You know, if it's a yellow, it's just really knock your eyes out. And if it's purple, it's very deep purple. The disadvantage to tetraploids is they grow slower. Or it may be an advantage, too. You don't have to divide them quite as often. But both the diploids and the tetraploids have just, you know, unbelievable color. You know, our daylily field, when it's in bloom, it is just
spectacular.
It's a spectacle. You know, it really is. It's just really, really beautiful.
Well, I tell you, I love mine, and I was really sorely disappointed because when we had our Wisconsin Public Radio get-together at our home, some of them were starting to flower. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the week after everybody was gone, then they were in full flower and looking just great. Oh, boy. Ryan in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Ryan.
Yes, sir. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Sir, I have a food plot with six different apple trees, two varieties.
Okay.
Basically, they're just there to feed deer. They're in the middle of 120 acres.
Okay.
I have the leaves have some discoloration.
Okay.
And there was like a web-like structure around one of the main, shafts of leaves.
Right.
Is there something that I can spray?
Okay.
Like a protective?
Yeah, the spots on the leaves, were they sort of orange?
Yes, okay, they kind of look like a little, like it was almost like little fire damage.
Yeah, it's called cedar apple rust.
Okay,
and cedar apple rust. Yeah, and what happens with that particular disease is it lives on the cedar or juniper. It's sort of an evergreen type plant during the winter, and then in the summertime it goes over onto the apple trees and lives on the apple. And if one of the two disappears, the disease goes away. And on a juniper or the cedar tree, they look like little galls, and then in the springtime they get sort of orangey gelatinous type filaments coming out, and that's when they're sporulating and the disease is going to the apple tree.
Okay.
If you get a lot of those on a leaf, the tree will actually defoliate early because it's trying to get rid of them. So if the leaves drop, don't be surprised. So that's one thing. That's the first thing that you've got. The second thing that you've got is probably tent caterpillars. And if that webby type thing, it's got little black worms running around on the inside of it, and they eventually go out and start eating your leaves. If it's in a spot where you can cut it out, it's probably the best thing to do is to cut it out and burn it, because that will get rid of it. If it's in a spot where you can't cut the, if it's too deep into the tree, what you can do is... There are two things that you can do. First thing you can do is kind of brush the web out of there, and then take a piece of newspaper and roll it up and kind of burn it. The other thing you can do is there's an insecticide called 7, or there's another one called 8, which is H is kind of a pyrethroid. You can spray with that, and that will take care of those tent caterpillars.
Good luck.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Dick Zondag, our guest president of the Jung Seed Company in Randolph, Wisconsin, celebrating 100 years in business. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller with Dick Zondag of Jung Seed Company. Pleased to have you listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison. At 263-1890. And let's go to Dagny in Marshfield next. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hello. I am wanting some suggestions on how to grow yellow beets.
Okay.
I have planted several years in a row, and it seems like only about 10 plants or so come out of two packages of beets, whereas the regular purple beets growing right beside it are doing fine.
Okay. Do you use any kind of... radish or something as a nurse crop for that particular?
No.
See, what I do in my garden, and that seems to help, is that I, when I'm planting the beets or the carrots, I always put a few radishes in. And what happens is the radishes kind of break the soil, come up fast, and they kind of mark the row, and they make it a little easier for the beets to germinate. Now, the yellow beets should be...
Shouldn't be a problem.
I've never had problems with either the red or the yellow beets.
Well,
so
the red ones are doing fine.
They
but,
are.
Out of packages, I got maybe 10 plants.
Yeah, that's not good.
And some years, nothing comes up.
I guess what I would do, now, are you planting them early or late?
When, I planted them about mid-May.
Okay. And that should be fine. I always plant my garden on Memorial Day because I'm really... too busy to get at it earlier, and it does really well because the soil temperatures are warmer at that time. Maybe try planting them a little bit later. You're from a little farther north than we are, and so maybe the soil temperature needs to be a little higher.
Yeah.
I'm not I'm not aware that yellow beets are harder to germinate than reds, but that may be a problem. But try putting a few radishes with them so it breaks the soil so they're, you know, a little easier for the seeds to germinate, and maybe try planting them a little bit later, because beets grow all summer long. It really, you don't have to plant them real early to get a good crop of beets. So
yeah, well, this year was about the earliest I've ever planted them. I'm, you know, early June or very late May.
But, well, that's when I do it on Memorial Day, and it seems to work pretty good.
Okay, I'll try that.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Dagny, for calling. Peggy in Stevenson, your turn. Hi, Peg.
Hello there. I have a question on shrubs. I'm, for the first time, doing some landscaping with shrubs, and
okay.
I want to do it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading a lot different places online about pruning, but I'm finding conflicting information whether you prune shrubs, you know, in the spring, in the fall.
Okay.
And so how do I know what's the correct information?
Okay, well, you've come to the right place, because I regularly do programs on pruning and stuff. What you have to remember is that if a shrub blossoms before the 4th of July, the flowers are on the plant before the plant goes into the winter.
Uh-huh.
And so what you want to do is prune after the flowers have flowered. So like with lilacs or mock orange or some of the spireas,
uh-huh.
if you prune them in early spring, you're cutting your flowers off.
Okay.
So that's the first rule. And
okay.
you can do that anytime. Your pruning can be any time from the time they stop blossoming until about the middle of August. Because
okay.
the flower buds on those plants will initiate in the fall prior to bloom. So the flowers are actually, you know, if you know what you're looking for on a lilac plant, in fact, you can find them. If you
mm-hmm.
look at the top of the shrub, the big fat bud at the terminal end will be your flower bud. The little sharp buds that are around it are the leaf buds.
Okay.
So that's number one. Number two is shrubs that blossom in the summertime, that will blossom from maybe the 1st of July through the fall,
okay.
such as a lot of the spireas, the potentillas, the honeysuckles, those sorts of things. They can be pruned anytime because the flowers come on new wood. So when a plant puts out a flush of growth, it'll have flowers at the end of it.
Okay.
So that's basically what you have to remember as far as timing is concerned. If it flowers in the summertime, it can be pruned anytime. In fact, with a lot of the spireas, after they're done blooming and those flowers turn brown, just take a head shears to them, give them a shot of fertilizer, they start to grow again, and in 3 or 4 weeks, you'll have another set of flowers.
Wonderful.
Where if you don't prune them, they've really done what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And they probably will flower a little bit, but they won't flower very much. So, you know, if you get a set of blossoms on a spirea or on a potentilla and they're done, just take a head shears to it, cut those dead flowers off or the spent flowers,
mm-hmm.
and give it a shot of fertilizer to encourage it to grow again, and you'll get another set of flowers.
Great. Wonderful.
That All help?
Right. Yes, very much. Thanks
okay.
so much.
Yep. Thanks so much for calling. And Leona in Milwaukee, I believe, is next. Let's go to you. Hi.
Hi. I have a kind of a two-part question about raised beds.
Okay.
I've heard that it's both either a good idea to till the soil before putting in a raised bed or to not till the soil because you want to preserve the microbiological life that's in the soil before putting in a raised bed. And I wanted to know what you thought about that. And then secondly, I also heard mixed opinions about putting in wood chips into compost that's then going to be used for growing plants. What do you feel about?
Okay, the first one, if you've got a very heavy soil, like clay, I don't think I would disturb that soil before you put the raised bed in. What I would do is put the raised bed in and then work some of the organic matter and stuff that you're putting into the raised bed in the area where the raised bed is sitting so that you don't have clay, and then you have your raised bed right above, because if the porosity of the soil is too different between the raised bed and the soil underlying, the raised bed will have to reach saturation before it starts draining, and it all has to do with the physics of soil science.
Mm-hmm.
So the area right underneath the raised bed, you do want to work some of the soil that you're putting in the raised bed into that soil so it's somewhat homogeneous. On the outside of the raised bed, I don't think I would disturb that at all.
Okay.
Okay.
Then wood chips in
wood
compost.
Chips in the compost. I wouldn't do it. The problem is that the reason that you're composting something is to get rid of the cellulose. And so with leaves and things like that, there's a lot of cellulose in it, but there's also a lot of other good things in it that you want to save for the soil. Wood is basically all cellulose. And by putting wood in a compost pile, it's going to take longer to work because wood is harder to decompose, and you're not going to have a lot of humus left over after the wood is composted. So if I were doing it, I wouldn't put wood in a compost pile. You know, you can use wood for a mulch because it doesn't decompose very rapidly. But if you're using wood as a mulch, you want to add some fertilizer to the soil so that the microorganisms that go after the wood to decompose it have some extra nutrients there, because if they're fighting with the plants for the nutrients that are in the soil, the microorganisms will win out and the plants will look starved, which I think is what was happening with the raised bed and too much organic matter. So,
okay, because I've also heard that wood chips provide a healthy environment for fungi to grow, and that fungi is what's helping.
Yeah, the microorganisms, which is fungi and the bacterium, some of the bacterium, do the decomposition. But the problem is wood is all cellulose, and that's what you're decomposing is the cellulose.
Okay.
And so, like with bedding that they use in horse barns and things like that, that's probably you can add that to the compost pile because it has nutrients in with it too. But if you use just those constituents for compost pile, you're not going to have a whole lot left over when you get done.
Okay. Sounds
all right.
Good. All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And on to Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nance.
Hi. I have some hydrangeas that we moved into a cottage about 20 years ago, and every fall we cut them back down, and every year they bloomed. And last year we didn't get one blossom, and this year we didn't either. But they grow 4 feet tall and very bushy, but they're not one blossom on
How
them.
Much did you fertilize them?
Not much. Okay. Never. Well, we leave the leaves and
no,
the,
that wouldn't do it. I mean, if you were putting a lot of fertilizer on, that could inhibit the plants from flowering.
No, we didn't fertilize.
Maybe then what you should do is fertilize.
Maybe use
a fertilizer not with too much nitrogen, but with some phosphorus and potassium in.
Okay.
You know, maybe a little bit of nitrogen. And the way you tell that, the first three numbers that are on a fertilizer bag are the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Those are the three numbers. The first number should be low compared to the other two numbers. And maybe work some of that into the soil. Maybe do some root pruning. Plants will naturally flower when they're under a little more stress. So get in there with a shovel, you know, all through the bed and chop up some of the root systems, you know. Maybe do it when your neighbors are not looking so they don't call the police.
Abusing my plants. Okay.
So you can do a little of both there.
Put them under a little bit of stress and give them a little bit of fertilizer. Okay,
less nitrogen, more phosphorus and potassium. And
root
pruning. And root. Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks for calling.
Bob in Darlington, hi to you.
Yeah, hi. Let me thank you first for taking my call.
Sure.
And let me say that I've used young seeds in my garden many, many times, and they've always been very excellent.
Oh, thank you.
My question is this. Early this spring, I planted with my summer squash and my cucumbers radishes, just a little red radish.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're overgrown, and they're flowering and everything, right. And they're large, weird little radishes now. Right. But you know what? Before I watered yesterday, I've got a moderate-sized garden.
Right.
Before I watered my garden yesterday, I looked for any signs of any insect, including the Japanese beetle, because Karen Johansson said that they've kind of invaded southern Wisconsin now to a certain extent.
Yeah. There are a lot of them around.
Yeah, and you know what? In my garden is completely free of any predators.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Isn't that great? I think. What do you think about the radish idea?
I've never heard of it being used that way, but, you know, radishes do have a very hairy leaf to them, and you know when you're pulling them, especially the older ones, that those hairy leaves have a sort of a spiny type structure to them. I don't know. Never heard that radishes inhibit insects, but it could be.
Boy, I've done this for years, mainly to inhibit
the vine borers, huh?
Yeah, the vine borers. That's right. Yeah, right. And boy, since we've been using the radish treatment, I just plant them right in with the.
Well, I'll have to remember that.
I'll have
to remember that because there are a lot of people that have problems with the squash and the vine borers.
We've had no problem since every year that we've done that, though. We've done it for a long time now.
Well, good.
And so I wondered what you thought about that. And what about no other insects?
Yeah, I really...
I was surprised at that.
I'm actually... the insect population has been kind of low this year. I mean, even in my rose garden and places like that where you'd expect to see the aphids and things like that, I think a lot of it has to do with the hot, dry weather. You know, usually in hot, dry weather, you're going to see a lot more mites than you going to see the aphids and the leaf hoppers because they need that moisture. So it may be partially the environmental conditions that we have this year, but I'll have to remember that. I'll plant some radishes with my vine crops and see if that helps.
I have to fight the weeds, like you say, but at least I don't have to battle against the insects.
Good for
sounds
you,
like,
Bob.
You've won one battle.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate the call. I should have asked Bob, if he lived next to a golf course, he would probably have some problems, especially Japanese beetles.
Oh, yeah, they're starting to invade, and they are very voracious eaters. They'll just clean a bush or any kind of plant out. They'll just eat the leaves right off.
Yeah. Mel in Madison, hi to you.
Thank you. I'm calling about a recurring problem in getting rid of a weed tree. There's a mulberry that comes back every year and tries to eat my chain-link fence, and I hack it back every year. And how can I kill it once and for all?
There are brush killers that you can put on. What you do is you paint, you cut the tops off, and then you paint the stump with this brush killer. And that should take the thing out. The other thing that I've seen some people use is Roundup. But see, with trees, the Roundup has to accumulate. You can't just do it once and expect the plant to die like you do with a lot of the quackgrass and things like that. I mean, with quackgrass, you spray with Roundup once and it's gone. But with trees, it seems like it has to accumulate in the tissues before it does its good. But there are brush killers that you can paint on the stump after you've cut them off, and that will inhibit them from growing back.
Mm-hmm. You paint it on right after you cut it.
Right after you cut it. Yep.
Yeah, and that's not anything that's going to be lingering too much.
Probably not. I mean, it does have some residual to it because it does it takes the plant out. But you know, we have them in the garden center, so you know, just be careful with it. You know, if you read the instructions and you store it properly, there's usually very few problems with that particular pesticide.
Well, thank you.
Yep.
All right. Thanks for calling. Sue in Onalaska, your turn. Hi, Sue.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question. I planted something called a bluebeard last year. It's something I'd seen in the southwestern part of the country.
Okay.
And it's in very sandy soil.
Okay.
It's in full sun.
Okay.
I put it in last year, and it flowered. It came back this year, and it's probably doubled in size. But it's very yellow-green.
Okay.
And it's more green toward the bottom and kind of more yellow as you go up.
And you're in a sandy soil?
Very sandy.
Okay. What I would say is you need to add organic matter to the soil that will hold nutrients in the soil so that you have nutrients around for that plant to grow on. And then the other thing you can do is get a product that has the manganese and the iron in it that the plant needs to be green. And I guess the most available one would be muriacid. It would be a fertilizer that would say for evergreens or azaleas.
Okay.
We have another one called the Holly Tone in the garden center that's excellent for plants that need to green up. It gives them the extra iron and manganese that's part of the chlorophyll molecule. And the reason it's green on the bottom and yellow on the top is that iron is not very mobile in a plant. so it's holding on to it down there.
Okay.
So get a fertilizer that says evergreen food or for acid-loving plants and, sure. and use that. But then also put organic mulch like cocoa beans or ground corn cobs, or you could even use leaves, and then just kind of incorporate those into the soil in the fall and put another layer on top of it so that you get some organic matter built up in the sandy soil.
Okay.
I believe they recommend on the bluebeard, too, that you prune them back in the spring and you get some vigorous growth going.
Yep.
Okay, great.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling, Sue. Appreciate it. 1-800-642-1234 or in the Madison area, 263-1890. The number is to call. Bonita and Boscobel, your turn. Hi, Bonita.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is about the top crop green beans.
Okay.
We've always grown them, and we have seen a progression over the last probably 5-6 years, going from like 1-foot beans to now 2-plus feet beans.
Okay.
And they are not standing upright. They want to lay down on the job. And we were just kind of curious as to why there has been this progression over the years of getting such tall top crop green beans.
Okay. It could be that the people that are producing the seed are selecting for a taller plant. How about the fertilizer? Have you fertilized them? Because that will cause excessive growth too.
Well, usually we do put manure on our garden, either cow or sheep or, mm-hmm.
okay.
you know.
From a cow yard?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe in the area that you do that, I would that you're going to put your beans, don't do that.
Okay.
Because if too much nitrogen will cause a plant. How about the other plants? Are your carrots getting larger? You know, the top's large. The tomatoes growing quite large too?
No, not really.
Okay.
Not anything excessive.
Okay.
Well, what you may want to do then is, you know, when you're buying your seeds, top crop is one of the oldest varieties that we have in the catalog. Maybe try some of the newer varieties, see if they don't work a little better. But I think the fertility of the soil is probably getting a little higher than you want it to be, and again, when those plants are grown, what they do is they select the plant that they think looks the most like top crop to be the parent seed for the next year. And if they're selecting mother plants that are getting taller, that may affect the way that the plants grow too. But I'm not aware that they're doing that. Usually once they get a variety like top crop set, they have those specific heights and pod size and things that they're looking for, and so they try not to screw around with the
yeah.
with the description of the plant. So
okay.
I think it's probably more soil-related than it is variety-related. But like I said, in the area where you're planting your beans, don't fertilize quite as much, and then maybe try a Blue Lakes or a Jade or one of the other newer bean varieties and see if they work better.
Alrighty.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot. Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company of Randolph, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking gardens with Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company of Randolph, Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you listening in. Let's go back to the phone. Susan in Madison has been waiting a while. Susan, hi. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Wondering about squash vine borers. You talked about radishes a few minutes ago, and that reminded me that my acorn squash look vigorous and wonderful, but, you know, there could be things attacking them underneath. Is this the time to be watching, and what do you...
Yeah, it is, and one of the things that you can do for the vine borer beside planting radishes, and I'm going to try that myself. You know, I've never heard of that, but it may be that it does inhibit them. But one of the other things that you can do is take a shovel full of soil, like every 4 or 5 feet, and put it over the vine where the tendril comes out, because the tendril is a structure that will turn into a root system if it's covered with soil. And so what you're doing is creating new little root systems everywhere on the vine. So if you get a cane borer in the vine between the fruit and the root system, it won't kill everything from there on out. So that's another way you can work at the vine borer. It seems like there are years when the vine borer is worse than others, and I haven't really heard a lot of people calling about having problems with the vine borer this year. But a good way to ensure that you get the squash is to just do that. Just take a small amount of dirt so that you cover the vine and the tendril. And they usually come out where a leaf comes out. On one side, the leaf comes out. On the other side, the tendril comes out. And you just cover it with a shovel full of soil, and it grows into another root system.
I'll try that. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Susan, for calling. Appreciate it. And Ed and Keeler, your turn now. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I got a tomato problem today.
Okay.
I got 9 plants, and 2 of them, they're all as tall as I am, big, bushy, million tomatoes on them, but 2 of them are starting to wilt on me, and I mean wilt down to like they're darn near dead. And then a couple days later, they'll look good again. And I think I'm dealing with a walnut tree problem.
Well, you could be dealing with a walnut tree problem if there is a walnut within 25 feet of your garden. Tomatoes are very susceptible to walnut, to the juglone that's in the walnut. The other thing that could be doing that too, though, is verticillium wilt. There is a wilt disease that bothers some of the tomatoes, and some of them are it will tell you in the catalog or in the wherever you're getting your tomatoes, the variety will have resistance to some diseases, whether it's fusarium or verticillium or, you know, different types of soil diseases, and that will cause those same symptoms, the wilting, because what happens is the fungus comes from the soil and gets up into the vascular system and will plug the vascular system. So when you get a hot, dry spell like this and the plant is under stress for water, it will wilt. So the way that you get around that is to use varieties that are resistant to wilt. And the other thing you want to do is rotate where you put them in the garden, because if you do have wilt and you plant tomatoes back there year after year after year, it's going to build up the amount of inoculum in the soil. So you want to rotate where you're putting your tomatoes, use varieties that are resistant to the verticillium wilt, and if it is the walnut tree, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the tree is roughly 32, 35 foot high.
Yeah.
And I'm 30 foot from it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are the tomatoes on the side of the garden towards the walnut tree?
Yes.
Yeah.
No.
I guess
that's all I have for a garden. Oh. 9 tomato plants.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah. Well, what you may want to do is take a shovel and go down, you know, a foot or a foot and a half between the walnut tree and the tomatoes, and see if you can cut off the root system. Because the thing about walnuts and anything in that family is that it excretes this organic herbicide, I guess you'd call it,
sure,
because it kills anything that's near it. It excretes it not only from the leaves, so rain will wash it out, but it comes out from the root system too. So down there, and if there are any roots from that walnut tree invading that soil, it will cut them out.
Okay.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. We have a lilac bush shrub that we planted. We planted a few years ago when our one daughter died, and mm-hmm. we planted it in her honor, and it has verticillium wilt. And boy, once it's there,
yeah.
The
only thing you can really do is to fertilize the plant. You know, verticillium and fusarium are not as deadly as Dutch elm disease. You know,
yeah.
You can fertilize a plant and water it and get it growing well, and it sometimes will even outgrow it if you do that. But you know, there are a lot of plants that are susceptible to verticillium wilt. It's not one that has a specific host, and mm-hmm. so. There are a lot of plants that maples can become infected with verticillium. And so the way you combat that is you keep the plant as healthy as possible, because when a plant is healthy, it seems like those diseases don't bother it quite as much. And so you can get those plants to survive by keeping them in good physical condition.
Wayne in Green Bay, your turn now. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question on gladiolas.
Okay.
What would be a good fertilizer you can still use to ensure you have nice blossoms on your gladiolas?
The one that we used to use when we grew our gladiolas was 6-24-24, but that's not one that's readily available There again, you don't want to have something that has too much nitrogen. And all the plants need nitrogen to grow. You don't want to give them too much, because with glads, the stalks will get taller and the bulbs will be more susceptible to storage rot. So just a good balanced fertilizer will work well with glads. A 555, a 888, and even though the 8 is the same number, it's not as readily available and it's not such an overpowering amount of nitrogen. So just if you can't find something that says for bulbs, and there are some garden centers that have what are called bulb booster type fertilizers. Those are excellent for bulbs. Just use a regular garden fertilizer and just take a coffee can and just run a line of fertilizer along the row where you're growing the glads and kind of work it into the soil.
Is that something you could use, say, right now yet?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, so how about a, I got some bulb food, which is a 1925-5. Would that be any good?
That would be fine, but go with a little smaller amount of it. But like I said, just put a small dressing on top of the ground and then just take a hoe or a cultivator and cultivate it into the ground and then water it in.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Yep. Yeah, thanks, Wayne, for calling. And Bob in Minocqua, your turn now. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
Say, we've got an oak tree in our yard. It's probably 7 inches in diameter. And I think it's like a swamp oak.
Okay.
And every year, now for the past 3 years, I've been losing the new growth off of the branches, probably the last foot or maybe even 16 inches of the new growth on most all of the tree. It's just like falling off the tree, and then it's turning brown on the grass. I have these big piles of branches on the grass that are turning brown, and I'm wondering what you might think that.
Okay, is this in a real wet situation by any chance?
No, it's really not.
Okay. See,
I'm
stretching my mind here, you know. It seems to me that oaks have the ability to form an abscission zone and drop off parts of the new growth when they're under stress.
Oh, okay.
And so maybe just, do you fertilize your lawn? Is it in a lawn area?
It's in a grassy area that never gets any fertilizer.
Yeah, see, I guess maybe that's what I would do is not necessarily lawn fertilizer, but something, maybe like I told the lady with the bluebeard, something that has a little bit more iron and manganese in it. What type of soil are you on?
In a very sandy soil.
Yeah, see, that's another thing too. You might have a little bit of acidity there too. That's what I would do. Is I'd go out and find an evergreen fertilizer or muriacid or something that has the iron and the manganese in it, and then I wouldn't fertilize near the trunk of the tree. You go out at the drip line of the tree, right?
Okay,
and then either put in some holes with a pipe and then fill those holes up with that fertilizer if it's granular, like the Hollytone would be, or if it's a soluble plant food like muriacid or another one, just take maybe 10 or 15 gallons of that particular solution and then just make a ring around the tree where the water would come off the tree, where the feeder roots are, and see if that doesn't help.
Yeah, the rest of the tree seems to be doing fine. You know, I mean, it's still dropping them now. In fact, there's dead branches up there.
Yeah. Are the leaves a little bit on the yellow side, too?
Just a tint, yeah.
See, and that's a sign that the chlorophyll is not real plentiful in there. So try that.
When could I do this?
You do it right now.
Okay, and you say this muriacid?
Muriacid, it's a fertilizer that comes in a blue box with a little black circle on it, and most garden centers should have it because it's a cousin of Miracle-Gro. It's in the Miracle-Gro family. It's called muriacid.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I very much appreciate the help.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Bob. And Frank, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Frank. Thanks for calling.
Good day, sir.
Hi.
I have a pea question and a raspberry question, if there's time.
Sure.
Anyway, the peas. I planted edible pod peas, like usually Oregon Giant.
Okay.
And I've had good luck up until the last couple of years. And what happens now, and I don't understand it, is that maybe only 5% or even less of the planted peas ever appear.
Okay, are you planting them in the same area every year?
Well, almost.
Yeah, see, what may be happening is there are diseases in the soil that will rot the seed before it even makes it out of the soil. That's why alternating or planting them in different areas helps, because that disease will build up in the soil if you plant them, you know, pea on pea on pea.
Yeah, well, I'm not doing that. It's in alternate areas, one year here and the next year back and forth. But
One of the ways that you can tell if the seed is good, if it's the seed is a problem, is, you know, maybe take 3 or 4 of the seeds out of the packet a couple of weeks before you plant it. Just put it in a paper towel, and you'll see whether the seed will germinate within 7 to 10 days. You'll see whether there's going to be anything out of it. So that's the way you can check the seed to see if the viability is there. And when do you plant the seed?
As early as I can.
Yeah, see, because peas can be planted when the soil is cold, because they will germinate in cold soil. So that sounds like you're doing it right. Do you inoculate the seeds with the inoculant?
I have tried just barely sprouting them and then planting the sprouted seeds.
No, there's a dust that you can put on the seed and then plant it.
Dick Zondag, our guest here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company, Randolph, Wisconsin, celebrating 100 years in business. Really pleased to have him along, and certainly you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And let's go to Frank. Frank, in Arborvitae, hi there again.
Yeah, thanks for getting back. Raspberries, Dick.
Okay.
How many years is it practical to keep a raspberry bed growing?
Well, theoretically speaking, you can keep it going forever.
Really?
But practically speaking, I would say probably 10 to 15 years would be the maximum. The problem is the leafhoppers start coming into your raspberries and start feeding on them, and if they've sat on a plant that had the viruses that caused the berries to be crumbly and to be smaller, and they feed on that plant, on the infected plant, they draw the viruses into their body, and then what they do is they go feed on a healthy plant, and then the way that leafhoppers work is they inject saliva into the leaf that dissolves cell walls, and then they draw the stuff out when it gets done, and by feeding on an infected plant, it draws in the viruses, and then when it goes to the healthy plant, it injects the viruses into the plant kind of incidentally and doesn't draw them all out, and then over a number of years, that plant will become infected with that virus, and then the virus usually causes the berries to be smaller and more crumbly, and so then you just have to take them out and start with new plants.
Does the virus stay in that soil?
No, it doesn't stay in the soil. It stays in the plant. No, it's not something that's in the soil. So you can put it in the same place, but you have to make sure that you get all of the roots out, because raspberries will sprout. The raspberry sprout from adventitious roots, so any of the old roots that you leave in the ground will have that virus in them too.
I see.
So if you don't take all the roots out, you'll have infected plants growing in between the new plants.
Well, let it wait a year or so and see what comes up.
That's what I would do.
Yeah. Okay, thanks.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Steve in Stevens Point, hi to you.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got some very distinct blotches developing in my lawn for the last couple years.
Okay.
It's just turning the normal grass into a real light green colorish. Have you heard of that before?
Okay, are you in a new house?
No, it's not new. The lawn is about 8 to 9 years old.
Okay, I think what's happening is if you dig down in those areas, you're going to find some wood or an old stump or something down there. Lots of times when people build houses, the easiest thing for the carpenters to do with the scraps of lumber is to just dig a hole and bury it and then put dirt over top of it. And what happens is as that wood starts to rot, it will the rotting organisms will be some fungal organisms, and some of them are very detrimental to lawns. They cause what's called a fairy ring, or they can actually cause rings of maybe a foot or a foot and a half in diameter where the grass is completely killed. So what I would do is, you know, maybe take one of those areas, maybe in a spot that isn't quite so visible, and dig down and see if there isn't an old stump or some buried lumber there. Otherwise, there are fungicides that you can use. If it's a fungal problem, being in Stevens Point, we have a garden center there, I'm sure that they would be able to help you with some of the fungicides that you can treat the soil with to see if it is a fungal problem. I guess that's all I could tell you.
Well, would I take a sample then to them, or just kind of explain the problem?
No, I just explain the problem to them and just tell them that you talked to me on the radio and that I recommended a soil fungicide for treatment. And what I would do is maybe treat a few of the areas and see if that helps.
Okay, because I did try Roundup on it, killed it all off. The University of Wisconsin Extension had recommended that.
And then starting with new seed.
And then I started new seed, and I'll be darned if it came back again in the same areas.
Okay. What I suspect is that you have something organic buried under there, and it's causing that fungus to grow again. So, you know, maybe dig up one of the areas, and if there's nothing there, then I guess I go into the garden center and see they can give you the soil fungicide that you need to take care of that.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Irene in Lakewood, your turn. Hi, Irene.
Hi. I have, we always gotten a lot of things from Young, and we really had good success. But this year, we try to grow a cilantro in a pot. And we get one stem, little leaves, and it does nothing else.
Okay. What kind of soil do you have in the pot?
Well, it's a mixture, you know, of clay, sand, brown colored.
Pot culture is a lot different than growing plants in the soil. What I would recommend for, you know, if you don't use a commercially made potting soil, if you're using something that you want to put your garden soil in, you should use a third sand, a third soil, and a third peat moss. And to that, then you add a fertilizer like Osmocote or plastic encapsulated fertilizer that has a membrane on it that every time you water the plant, it leaches a little bit of that fertilizer out.
Okay.
And I think you'd have much better luck with that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Just wanted to mention, got an email from Jeff Volkschaller, who is the senior instrumentation specialist at the botany department in Burge Hall on the UW-Madison campus. And he tells us that the botany greenhouse has yet another Titan arum blooming. Says it's getting very difficult to convince people this is a once-in-a-lifetime event. Since
they've had a lot of them.
Six blooms in 7 years. So he was betting that that it was going to open. He sent this on Wednesday. He was betting it would open on today. And I think some others in the greenhouse were betting on Monday. But if anybody wants to see Titan arum, it probably wouldn't be a bad time to go in Madison to the University of Wisconsin greenhouse. It's open Monday through Friday, 7 to 4, closed on the weekend. And the interesting thing about it is its smell.
Yeah, it's horrid.
It smells like somebody died.
Rotting flesh. Yeah,
flesh.
It's a desert plant that attracts moths by having this awful smell, and they will pollinate the plant so it produces seed. But those plants are awful. I mean, the smell is almost unbearable. But it's such an unusual thing to have one of those, and they're so huge. I mean,
yeah,
they're
enormous.
Just unbelievably. I mean, it's and like he said, you know, people are starting to wonder because, you know, it is really once in a lifetime. They bloom once and then they're done. Mm.
So, but they've managed to get six of them to bloom in 7 years. So
they must be using the right fertilizer or the right soil or something.
You've got to be doing something right. Anyway.
Maybe it's something in the air around Burge Hall or
around
something.
Burge Hall.
I don't know.
And Burge Hall is sort of on the side. It would be the south side, I guess. South.
Yep, south side of the mall.
Of Bascom Hill, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Carlina in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Carlina.
Oh, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
My sister planted some tomatoes in her new deck.
Okay.
And first time that they bloomed, new tomatoes came out about an inch in diameter. But they have this brown circle in the bottom of the tomato, all of them.
Yeah.
It's
called blossom end rot. Yeah. Larry, you could do this program by yourself.
Oh, I've had that in past years, this year.
No, blossom end rot, it's a lack of calcium in the soil. So use some lime, and in a lot of cases, because it's in a pot, it has a high organic soil and there isn't a lot of calcium in organic matter. So just get there are products that are called blossom end rot, but it's basically calcium and or lime, and just put some around the plant and work it into the soil. And unfortunately, the ones that have it already, in fact, I don't know that the plant will recover from it, but in next year it'll be fine.
Okay. To do with blooms then.
Yeah.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And sometimes isn't that caused by sort of water issues?
Yeah, there are a multitude of things that can cause blossom end rot. Overwatering for sure, because that blossom end is a little more susceptible. But in a pot, you know, they usually have it either trained on a stake or you have a variety that doesn't touch the ground, because when it's rotting from the ground, it's usually when the tomato is prostrate on the ground and just kind of crawling across the ground. And then if you're watering them too much, then you can cause those tomatoes to rot too.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Carolina. Appreciate it. Lori in Sparta, your turn. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have purchased a flowering quince, and it is a zone 5
Great.
Plant.
Great.
Yep.
And I planted it very close to the house, and I am wondering if there's anything I can do in the winter to help protect it. Like rapid and burlap.
You're a zone 4 there, aren't
yeah,
you?
It's something that will either grow or it won't grow. There really isn't a lot of things that you can do. You can maybe mulch it a little bit. Covering it with a single layer burlap would maybe help a little bit. But if you get extremely cold weather, it's going to freeze. If you get a snow cover, I mean, if it was covered with snow, it would be fine because the snow will insulate it. So if you get a really light snow, maybe you'll want to put some of that snow, throw it into the bush. But flowering quince is quite a brittle wood, too, so you have to be careful. You can't take a heavy snow and throw it in there. But
yeah.
Anything that can insulate the plant will help it.
This is one that only gets 3 feet high.
Right.
And it has some little quinces on it right now.
Right. And I have we have some flowering. We have a couple of them growing around the building, and they do flower every third year or so.
Uh-huh.
The ones that we have are not the fruiting type quinces.
Oh.
But, you know, if you get one that has the fruiting type, quince is actually in the apple family, and quince is actually a very, a fruit that's very high in pectin, so it's used a lot in jelly, and that's why, you know, a lot of the jellies are apple quince or cherry quince jellies.
I Googled everything I could learn about it, except I wasn't quite sure. It's sitting right very close to the house,
yeah.
But it's got river rock everywhere,
yeah,
rather than mulch.
Yeah, I guess is it on the east side of the house?
Yes.
Yeah, that would be the best exposure to be on.
Okay.
So it sounds like you've got it in a spot where it might have a chance, but
burlap might help.
Yeah, just throw a single layer of burlap wouldn't hurt it. I mean,
uh-huh.
That isn't going to kill it if it's a problem. But you know, with zone 5 plants, if people want to try them, I always say fine, you know, it's fine to try it. But then if the thing dies, don't bother putting it back, because probably going to do it again.
Yeah, I thought it
unless you want to keep us in business, you know.
Yeah.
Although we don't sell flowering quince.
I don't have the tag, but I thought it said good to minus something.
Yeah.
Well,
It's a little tender for this area.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Lori. Thanks for calling. Well, Deborah in Minocqua has a question for us, so let's go to Deb. Hi, Deb.
Hi. I have a zucchini problem.
Uh-oh.
And we love to grow it, and it starts out really well, and it blossoms, and the zucchinis get a few inches long, and all of a sudden the ends turn yellow, and they shrivel up. And I was wondering if you could tell me why that happens.
That's a good one. Usually people are looking for people to give away zucchini. You know, I was at a mm-hmm. conference of the Mail Order Gardening Association that was held here in Madison a couple days ago. One of the jokes one of the guys said is, you know why people lock their cars in the middle of summer? Yeah. To keep people filling them with zucchini.
Well, we love zucchini, and yeah. we do get a few, but most of them turn yellow on the very end.
What kind of soil do you have?
We have sandy soil, okay, but my husband's family has a farm in Stratford, so we get a lot of horse manure, and we put it on the garden because he said that's really good for the plants.
Yeah. Maybe in the area where you're putting the zucchini, don't do that because does it have a lot of wood in it?
No.
Okay, so mm-hmm. that isn't it.
And
because
we also grow green beans and tomatoes, and they do wonderful.
Yeah. Maybe what you want to do is try a little bit more fertilizer in that area, mm-hmm. because usually yellowing is a nutrient deficiency thing.
Okay.
Or in some cases it is. Some cases it's disease, too, but just try giving it a little extra fertilizer, but not a lot, because zucchinis can be a very aggressive vine, too, and it can take over your garden
okay,
if you put too much nitrogen.
Okay, but that wouldn't have anything to do with overwatering, would it?
No.
Okay.
No, probably not.
All right, so just try fertilizer.
Fertilizer, and then, yeah, I guess that's what I would do.
Is there a specific fertilizer I should use?
Just a well-balanced fertilizer, anything that says garden fertilizer on it.
Okay, great.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Deb. Steve in McGuanago, hello to you.
Yeah, hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi, I've got a question about some basil that I'm trying to grow, and it seems to be very well liked by the Japanese beetles in the area, and I don't want to apply any sort of pesticide. So I was wondering if you had any ideas in terms of organic techniques to control that.
How about insecticidal soap?
Okay, no problem.
Insecticidal soap would not, that's considered organic and would help with Japanese beetle. The other thing you can do is maybe use some of the Japanese beetle traps to take them out. You know, it's a trap where they get in and they can't get out. That might do it. You put an attractant in it. The problem with Japanese beetle traps, though, is that they seem to attract the
Japanese beetles from your
neighbor's lawn, too. So, you know, maybe put them a ways away, but that would help reduce. But I think the insecticidal soap would help you also.
What about, I'm wondering, how big of an area have you got a basil? Is this
this is just in a container on the patio.
Okay. Oh, you could probably stick a little. I'm trying to think.
A sticky strip.
Either a sticky strip, or I was thinking of the garden screening material that you can just put over it and just protect it that way, because the water and light gets through. If it's just in a pot,
sort of like a row cover type.
Those were the words I was trying to come up with. A little piece of floating row cover that you could probably tie around it.
That would be a barrier that they couldn't go through, yeah. And as Larry said, it's a great thing because it lets the sunlight through, it lets the water through, but it won't let the insects through. That would be another idea for a Japanese beetle.
Yeah. Yeah, you bet, Steve. Thanks for calling. And Todd in Elk Mound, hello to you.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I have a question. I have about a 10-year-old established perennial garden that we have to move because of construction, most of which is there are a lot of hostas, some Jacob's ladders and other things, but mostly hostas.
Okay.
Should I clip those down or just move them as they are?
What I would do is try to take as much soil as you can with them.
Okay.
I wouldn't try to divide them or do anything else with them because they're in vigorous growth right now, and it's really the hardest time to transplant hostas. But if they have to be moved, what I would do is just take a shovel and go probably 6 inches away from the crown at least, and then just go around with that shovel and kind of stick it in the ground so you cut some of the roots, and then try to lift that ball and then make a hole that's the same size or a little bit bigger, so when you put it back in the ground, you don't disturb it. And then water them good
okay.
when you put them back in the ground.
how about any of my other perennials in, like, the Jacob's Ladders, or, you know, we've got some Buckeyes and so forth, a lot of which are in bloom, of course.
Should yeah, and they're as susceptible to not being... the Buckeye doesn't like to be moved, so I mean, you can try it, and that's probably the best way of... the method that you'd have the best success with is to try to... try to take as much soil as you can with them, and then when you get them transplanted, don't water them every day, but keep them quite moist so that they're not stressed out.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling.
And on to Richard in Castle Rock. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Yesterday I was in Monroe, and I was walking on the streets, and I saw what I think was a maple tree. It had a maple-type leaf anyhow, and it was dark green in the center and kind of a real pale or white on the outside edges all the way around the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what it was and if they're available.
Yes, it's. I think it's a variety called Harlequin maple. It's actually a Norway maple with variegated leaves.
Harlequin?
Harlequin, yeah. And we have had it in the past. I'm not sure if we had it this year. The problem is the post office doesn't like to ship trees for us, and they have just absolutely creamed us with the new postal rates as far as shipping trees, and I'm not sure that we're going to have a lot of trees in the catalog. We will have them in the garden centers, though, but that one is called Harlequin Maple.
And, are they available now in your stores, or would in the spring?
No, I'm pretty sure we have them. What I would do is call ahead just to make sure. I don't have inventory sheets with me. But one of the things with Harlequin maple is it's a mutation from a Norway maple. And what happens sometimes with those trees is you'll get one branch that will revert back to green.
Yeah.
You got to cut that out immediately, because I've seen some of the Harlequin maples planted in Randolph where the green has kind of taken over. Not because the whole tree reverts back to green, but because that green branch will grow much faster and will actually take over the tree. So, you know, it's a very unusual looking tree, but you've got to make sure that you don't let any of it revert back to green.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll check the store on 18 in Madison. That's closest to me.
Okay, all right. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling. Harold in Madison, hi to you.
Hi.
Hello.
Yes.
What can we do for you?
What I'm calling about is what do you do before, during, and after for Japanese beetles?
No. Okay, before Japanese beetles, you can use milky spore. The Japanese beetles will form the larval stage is in the soil, and so you've got to use a product called milky spore. And what that does is if that larval stage ingests the milky spore, it kills them. The problem with milky spore is it's not inexpensive, and you have to do it like 2 or 3 years in a row. And if you do that, the microorganisms that's in that milky spore will build up in the soil and will take care of it. During a Japanese beetle invasion, if you don't want to use pesticides, I guess the only way to do it is to put out traps.
Yeah.
There are insecticides. A 7 is one. 8 is another one. There are several insecticides that you can use that are pretty effective against Japanese beetle. After fertilize the plant, because it's going to have all its leaves gone. get it growing again. There's not a whole lot else you can do.
And thanks very much for calling. And Dick, thank you so much. I know you're going to have a great event tomorrow. What, 10 to 4 tomorrow?
10 to whenever people go home, I guess. We're having Jungfest in Randolph. So
that'll be a lot of fun. In Randolph, Wisconsin, Dick Zondag, president of the Jung Seed Company. Great event tomorrow. You're invited. Big weekend at Jungfest tomorrow from 10 until whenever. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening.